What do Tootsie Rolls, Jujubes, and Hot Tamales all have in common? They're candies that originated right here in New York City. Hi, I'm George Bodarkey, and this is Cityscape. On today's show, we're taking a bite into candy history. Our guest is Susan Benjamin. She's the author of Sweet as Sin, the unwrapped story of how candy became America's favorite pleasure. Susan, thanks so much for coming in.
Happy to be here.
So first things first, what's your favorite candy?
Everybody asks me that.
And here I thought I was being unique.
No, well, it is unique in its own way. And the answer is always the same. So I'm trying to find a different way to answer it. But I really, really love the story of candy. And all of these stories have, all the candies have amazing backgrounds and amazing purposes. So that's what interests me the most. And when I say that I don't have a favorite, I really mean it.
Uh-huh.
I really do. Yeah.
What inspired this great interest in candy?
I was a communication strategist. I had a whole nother life, and I was kind of bored with it, you know, and it was just becoming a grind. And somebody asked me a question about candy, and it was a really interesting question. And it was about, you know, where did it begin, or what was the oldest candy, or something like that. And because I had been doing research and so on, I started researching candy. And lo and behold, here was this unbelievably interesting and pertinent, relevant story, and nobody knew it. And the more I dug, the more I found. And lo and behold, here we had this whole universe of just fascinating information that ranged from the terrain of the Native Americans to the reasons for slavery, the lives of the enslaved people, the Industrial Revolution. I mean, going on and on and on. So I couldn't help myself and left my other life and started this one.
So does the story of candy in America begin with the Native Americans?
The story of candy begins with the Native Americans. So candy meaning things that are sugar-based and pleasant to eat, I would say. The sugar was not the cane sugar, but in fact, most of the sugar Americans eat today isn't cane either. So
talk to me about the candy that was being consumed by Native Americans.
The Native Americans made really good use of whatever was around them, and most of the things we see in candy today wasn't there. So one example would be, let me tell you what they did. They did eat instead the corn cob, for example. They candied the corn cob, and they would boil it and make a sweet dish out of that. Of course, everybody knows they had the maple. They used cactus in various ways and found other sweeteners from the fruit. So the cranberry, for example, which was really important to the native peoples, was a great value to them as a preservative because it had the acid, but also the sugar, which they mixed into such dishes as the pemmican that people know today.
You brought some candy with you today.
I always do.
And you brought something here that looks like tree bark.
It is tree bark.
It is tree bark.
It is. And the tree bark in this case is the hickory bark. And the Native Americans made great use out of that as a toothbrush. They boiled it. They did a number of things, not only with the bark, but really with all parts of the hickory tree. And that one in particular, later European Americans boiled. Maybe they add a little sugar to it. And they sold it as what they called, one of the various names they called it was Mapleine.
Mapleine.
Getting people to believe it is the maple syrup, which it is not. But I'll tell you ought to try that boiled hickory bark. It's delicious.
So would I just chew on this bark?
You know, you could. And I'll tell you, it tastes like bark. It's not going to have the flavor
it tastes like bark, yeah.
Yes, I did give you another root.
Mm-hmm.
I gave you a couple, but one of them is a stick. It's in the other bag, I believe.
Okay, in this bag here?
Yes.
Oh, there it is. Yes,
and
I see it.
And there's a root there. So this particular root came over with the British in the 1600s. It may have been here already, but I don't think so. I cannot source that. And they gave it to the Native Americans who really liked it, and they indeed passed it on to the enslaved people. So it was boiled, it was used as a medicine, it was used as a toothbrush, of course, and so on. So why don't you want to take a little try, see what you think?
And this is actually quite delicious.
You think so?
Yes, this has a great flavor.
Does it taste familiar? It went on to become a penny candy in the mid-1800s.
It does taste familiar, but I can't place it, so you're going to have to tell me.
It's the licorice root.
It's the licorice root.
It is. It's the licorice root. And people would chew it, and they would sort of swish it on their teeth and so forth. And I have a shop in Harper's Ferry. I have a couple shops. And people come in, and they see that root, and they say, "What? Why do you have a root there?" Or even better, a stick there. And not knowing that it's an anomaly in history that we don't chew roots anymore. But that's the origin of the licorice candy.
You reference your shops. Tell me about your shops.
I have two shops right now, and we sell a lot to museums and other places as well. One is based in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia, right at the site of John Brown's raid, and one is in Frederick, Maryland. And the purpose of what we do is to tell people about the history of candy in a visceral way, so they can buy the candy or not, but all the stories are on the bags. And all of my employees know the stories, and they tell them. And I must say that there's not a person who walks in who doesn't walk out really surprised at how interesting and relevant those stories are.
And what is the name of your shop?
The name of my shop is True Treats Historic Candy.
True Treats Historic Candy. Yeah. So when did candy as we know it today, not in the form of a tree root, when did that start to take shape?
Oh, it's such a fascinating thing. That actually started around the mid-1800s. The very first candy was made by a woman who was shipwrecked coming over from England in 1806. Her name was Mrs. Spencer. That candy was the Gibraltar. And as she sold it, she had a horse and buggy that she rode on, all by herself, by the way. She was a single mother in the early 1800s. And under her seat, I have found out, she had a false bottom. And she was part of the Underground Railroad and carried escaped slaves. So really interesting. But not that much happened till the mid-1800s. And then you see two things. One is that you have the increase of machinery, which is amazing. And then you have the drop in the prices of sugar. You also have the knowledge that many of the candy makers, and really everybody else, had that you could market stuff, and you could really market it in a good way. And that was the beginning of this new thing that they could sell to kids, which was candy. What's really important about that, in terms of our culture, our society, and our lives today even, is that that candy was available to working class kids and the much maligned children of immigrants. Hmm. For the first time, they could go into the candy stores, at that time it was more the apothecaries, the general stores, and so forth, and figure out how to spend their money. And that made them part not only of a consumer culture, but part of the middle class for the first time. Guess what the well-to-do thought of that?
They didn't like it so much.
They did not like it, and they blamed it on everything from alcohol abuse to sexual deviance. I mean, it's really, when you look at what they were saying, you think, oh, my word. And that idea of candy lingers with us today, that it's a second-rate kind of food, that it's really bad for you, when in fact it really isn't that bad for you, particularly if you eat it in healthy, small amounts.
Not great for our teeth, though, of course.
No, that's not really true.
Is that right?
Yeah, I would say not, if you compare it to other things. So if you consider chewing gum a candy, which I do, the early chewing gums were, as the roots, were used for your teeth, and they were made out of the resins of trees. So the first commercial European-made chewing gum was spruce tree resin. William Wrigley got his start selling the spruce tree resin as, it's really kind of funny, as a premium. He was really selling baking soda. Everybody liked the spruce tree resin better, and so he went into that line of work and became the candy magnate that we know of today. So I would say that, you know, it's really hard because what you're really talking about isn't candy anyway, it's sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a little bit different.
Yeah, yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, you can have candy with not a lot of sugar in it.
You made a point to say that you see gum as candy. Is that a great debate?
Not that I know of. But some people might go, wait a minute, is that really candy? Yeah, I consider it candy. When we're looking at catalogs of candy, or I go to all of the conferences and everything, it's chocolate, gum, and candy. But you know, they're all the same thing.
You mentioned that candy was first sold in apothecary.
Mm-hmm.
When did the candy store, as we know it today, come into play?
That came around with the penny candy stores around the turn of the century. And the reason why the candy came out of the apothecaries was because the candies that we have today were originally in a slightly different form, although not in all cases, was the medicine. So candy evolved out of the medicines, the boiled sugars, for example. Would you like to know the first candy?
I do want to know the first candy, yes.
Okay, this is another one. This is like, people are so shocked. And if any of your listeners don't know this candy, just walk into your local gas station, because they sell it there. A guy named Oliver Chase was a pharmacist. He was from England, and he really wanted to make a pill cutter, because in those days, when you cut pills, you had a knife, and it was so hard to do, and you couldn't measure, and you couldn't come up with great doses, and on and on and on. So what he did is he succeeded. He made a little pill cutter. And he took some of the really bad-tasting medicine out, and he left the good-tasting medicine in. And he named that the Hub Wafer, or the Chase Lozenge, which later became known as the Necco Wafer.
That Necco Wafer
that was in 1847, his brother Daniel, about 10 years later, made a stamp machine, and he had his own candy, which we call today the Conversation Hearts. That was his brother. That you have at Valentine's Day.
Yes. And you brought me both of those
and
today.
Do you like them?
I do like them. Good. So, yes.
Some people
It's been
do,
a long time, though,
don't.
Since I've had a Necco wafer. So, thank you for bringing me.
Yeah, enjoy it. And those, by the way, the original colors and flavors.
Great.
Yeah.
Now, you've already made some reference to this, but I'm hoping we can talk about it a little bit more, because I know that you say you can't talk about the role of candy without talking about the role of slavery
Absolutely.
In America.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So the reason why we had slavery is, without a doubt, because we had cane sugar. And if at any time the cane sugar industry had fallen apart and gone bankrupt, there would have been no need for slavery, and it would have ended. So that in itself is really significant. The abolitionists went on to boycott the cane sugar, but they needed to have sugar. So unlike today, everybody I know is really paranoid of sugar. And when they come in the shop, or even when I give talks, they're always like, oh my gosh, I'd love to have some butt. And there's this sense of almost like it's an opiate or something, like really bad. But historically, that's not the case. Historically, it was a medicine. It was used for fermentation. It was used for so many different things and so important. So if you're not going to have cane sugar, what are you going to do? So the abolitionists found a whole number of other sugars, either that were domestic, such as the maple sugar, but hard to get, or that they got behind, such as the sorghum and the beet sugar. And they promoted those. And those two, beyond any of the alternatives, really did take off. The beet sugar ultimately won out because it could crystallize after the Civil War. And today, Americans, the sugar that most Americans have, 55% about, is from the beet. It's not cane. We don't eat cane sugar.
Huh.
Yeah, we eat beet sugar. And that was one of the many that the abolitionists had. The enslaved people also were really important to the production of sugar, as were African Americans in general. They were really innovative and came up with new machinery and really contributed a lot. In researching candy, I read through so many volumes of interviews with enslaved people at the time of slavery. So there are some that many people know during the Depression, but these really were the older ones. Their lives were extraordinary. And I would say, of everything I really learned about in researching candy, it was who these people were, for as much as you can understand, and how they really are, in a single word, survivors. Extraordinary just what they went through and how they managed to survive. And that goes back directly to the sugarcane.
What would you say, Susan, was the most pivotal moment in candy history?
The most pivotal moment in candy history would be the Industrial Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
It was a long time, and obviously it affected everything. But, you know, the fascinating thing to me, and it comes out in with candy, studying candy anyway, is that we lived one way for thousands and thousands of years. And, you know, we may have colored the candy with saffron or other things, but we really didn't do that much. And all of a sudden, our entire relationship to food shifted. So we had the licorice root that I gave you, mm-hmm. and today we have the licorice twists, which don't have licorice in it, and are bright colors, and who knows what colors, and the scent comes from whatever they put in it to make it smell funny or good or whatever. So that, to me, is the really the most remarkable aspect, but it reflects on all of the food that we eat and our relationship to food today. Can I add one little point there?
Go ahead.
One of the really amazing things is how they came up with the names for the candy, because mm-hmm. marketing was so important.
Yeah, I want to talk about some of these iconic candies that we know and
to.
The names, like the Tootsie Roll, which has a New York City connection. And there is a very sad story behind the Tootsie Roll.
Yeah, and I don't like to, I don't even like to tell people in the shop because they're usually happy when they're there. But the inventor of the Tootsie Roll, whose name was Hirschfield, it's not clear what he was. He may have been this immigrant who came and made candy and really built up this empire, or he may have been more likely a vice president at a company and an inventor. But what he did do was he invented the Tootsie Roll, and he also invented a wrapping machine for the Tootsie Roll, which was really important. He called it Tootsie because of his daughter, whose middle name was Tootsie. But it could also be that that a nickname for little baby's toes was Tootsie. Mm. So that was the name of the Tootsie Roll. And the part that you're alluding to, which is so sad, is that, in fact, during the Depression, he did kill himself. Mm. And the reason he did was the company he worked for fired him. He was absolutely devastated, kept trying to rebuild his candy life and never could. And as you can imagine, there are a lot of stories like that throughout the history of candy as well.
But the Tootsie Roll born here in New York City.
In New York. Oh, are you kidding? In New York? Okay, New Yorkers. The Staten Island, that's where the first Chicle gum came from. The deposed president of Mexico. Now, if you were a deposed president of Mexico in the 1800s and your name was Santa Ana, if that doesn't ring a bell, he was the guy. Well, he was the guy who sort of made the Alamo possible. And by the way, killed Davy Crockett. He had to go somewhere. He was deposed. If you were deposed, where would you go? Staten Island, New York, of
course.
There you
go.
What better place? He did. He brought the Chicle with him, hooked up with this guy. And the Chiclet, or the Chicle gum, then the Chiclet, and all the chewing gums that we knew for many, many years, that was the beginning of it, right in Staten Island.
The Sugar Daddy.
The Sugar Daddy.
Once known as the Papa Sucker.
Was known as that. Isn't that embarrassing?
It is. I'm blushing
I'm
right
glad
now.
That they changed.
What's the story behind that
well,
name?
Well, that was the marketing. So they had the Sugar Mama, and there's the Sugar Baby, and the Sugar Daddy. The other one that was around the 1925 that certainly everybody knows is the Milk Duds. So the Milk Duds, a great story. They were supposed to be called milk balls and to be very round and beautiful. But the chocolate kept caving in and denting the caramel. And so that it would sort of look wobbly and it didn't look right. And the candy maker said, forget it. We can't make it because we have to have a name. Because now, as today, marketing was becoming first before the actual product. And somebody went, it's a dud. And let's call it Milk Dud. The first candy, probably one of the only foods named for its liability. Yeah.
The Cracker Jack, surprising to me, was not a popular treat until after that famous song came on the scene, Take Me Out to the Ball Game. I would have thought that it would have been popular before that song.
No, it rhymed with the song, so that's why they stuck it in, Cracker Jack. And then it became, of course, an iconic kind of candy. And it's funny because the treat, the little prize inside of the Cracker Jack, actually was common for the day. And that was in the turn of the century into the 20s. The awareness that marketers had then, which they still have today, that if you get them young, you keep them. And why not give them little prizes inside? Those are the premiums. They'll go and buy it and get a little gift. And so there was nothing unique about it, but it was really typical of what food people in particular and the candy people were doing. Can I give you another example?
Please.
This is great. So the wax lips. Do you know those wax lips?
I do know the wax lips,
and
yes.
And you do know the nickel nip, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the wax lips and the nickel nip were made as a result of the petroleum industry, which originated in Titusville, Pennsylvania, believe it or not. And one of the, what was left over was a paraffin wax. And an enterprising guy thought, you know, I'm going to take this and I'm going to make a really cool kind of a chewing gum, because the chewing gums were hard then. And he did. And he made up to 150 different styles. There were horse's teeth and, of course, the lips. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he did was he took the idea of a candy premium being the toy, and he made tops so the kids could turn these waxy tops and then pick them up and eat them.
Huh.
So it's sort of a premium with a slant.
I think some of the biggest names in candy mm-hmm. that we still know today are Hershey, Mars, Reese's. Did they all come about at around the same time?
They did, yes. Reese was a dairy farmer, and Hershey was one of his customers. So Hershey moved to what is now known as Hershey because of the dairy industry, because it was all right there, and he could set up railroads, and people would the dairy farmers would be able to send their milk that way, but also his employees could get there, and it was a real targeted choice to do that, and one that everybody all around the country was doing anyway. I mean, you had to have the railroad, and he did that. His neighbor was Reese, and then around that time, the Mars family, of course, came about, and the father and son, who are in bad terms, and over in England, you get all the Quakers, and they're busily creating all this chocolate, because being Quakers, there wasn't a lot else to do, right? That was really above board. So they were inventing things like the Fry invented the chocolate bar, and Hershey added almonds to that. And it was a whole mix and mingle of personalities who, as everywhere, knew each other.
How fiercely competitive were these families?
Please. Even the Quakers. So you figure that the Quakers, at least when it came to enslavement, the Quakers were really good people. They were really took the high road. They used to sneak into each other's companies to spy on each other. And Deborah Cadbury has a really good book called The Chocolate Wars, which talks about that. But Milton Hershey used to take trips to Europe and sort of go around Europe. And some of what he did was sort of peek in and see what, probably by telling him that he was a worker and getting a job there, and getting ideas and candy from his competitors. So it was hilarious. And I just want to add, it still is. I went to the Wilbur Company, mm-hmm. which is a wonderful, wonderful company with a great, they were the originators of the Hershey Kiss. The Kiss was a family of candies, and they had their own called the Wilbur Bud. So I went to the plant to talk to some of the workers. And I'm telling you, you could spit from the bathroom door to their desk, huh. and they had to stand right in front of the bathroom door anyway, just in case they should happen to look around and find any of the secrets. And I was just interviewing them for a book. What a book author steal, you know, not a lot. So it still is that way. Yeah, very competitive and secretive.
What can you tell us about the role of candy, and more specifically, the role of chocolate during wartime, specifically World War II?
Well, okay, so the role of candy really, I mean, it's always been around. For as long as candy's been around, it's been for wars. But the reason that happened was partly because of shortages. And if you're not making it for the war effort, then you're not making it. You asked about World War II, which most people know because of the Hershey Industries marvelous marketing with the D-ration, mm-hmm. the so-called D-ration. But it really began with World War I, where you now have chocolate bars in something new, which was the rations. And one of them was the Clark bar, you know, the Clark bar, mm-hmm. and another one was Goldenberg's peanut chew. They went off with the Doughboys in 1917. The Doughboys came back and they demanded chocolate bars. And in fact, in an interview they did with all of these returning veterans, they said, what do you like about the food and what would you like us to change? And they said, everybody in every ration should have candy bars. That created the candy bar industry we have today, which during the Depression was marketed as those candy bars as an inexpensive meal in a bar. Hmm. And so unlike other places, other candies rather, they didn't suffer and wound up morphing into what we have today, the diet bar, the protein bar, and so forth. In between that, you had World War II. And everything went to World War II. The Rokeby, everything. I mean, the neck away from it. And it's just what happened. All the chewing gum that was around went to World War II. William Wrigley advertised for his chewing gum like crazy then because there wasn't any. And he was going to get everybody to chew his gum after the war when they could have chewing gum again. But what was unique about the D-ration was that the War Department went and asked the Hershey Company, William Morey, I believe it was, who was the president, if they could make a chocolate bar that was so bad that the soldiers wouldn't want to eat it and had something like just hundreds of calories and was really, really dense. And anything could happen. A piece of shrapnel could pierce it and it would stay in one place. So, in fact, that's what they did. So you have to remember.
And the point of that was?
That they would eat it if they were under duress. So there's no more food left and they know they'll have that because they didn't want to eat it before. Mm-hmm. That was the point. So, you know, you're thinking about in the Pacific, for example, you've got these soldiers who are up against malaria, they're up against being captured and tortured, and they're up against death, amongst many other horrible things. And they still had the energy to write the War Department because they hated that D-ration so much, they absolutely could not stand it. So so they wound up creating an alternative called the tropical bar. And you would imagine, you know, shaved coconut and little bits of pineapple. Yeah. No, it was just had more sugar in it. And it was better. It wasn't quite as bad.
Speaking of rations, what else did you give me here in my ration bags?
Well, I gave you all sorts of things. Is there anything you'd like to talk about in particular? I'd be really happy to.
Yes, there's this. The squirrel nut zipper.
Okay, yes, the squirrel nut zipper, and also with it, the Mary Jane, and you have a number of others. Those are the toffees of the 1920s.
Yeah.
So an interesting thing happened because as sugar, cane sugar, became more available to kids and so forth, we also saw the rising of the temperance movement. And the association for them with sugar was that it was used in fermentation. So not only were these working class kids who were so out of control eating it, but they could also, some even said, you know, they would eat this candy and it would sit in their stomachs and turn into alcohol, right? Uh-huh. I mean, some of the fringe groups, I'm sure. But in any event, the candy industry was not going to take this lying down. So they named their candies, some of them, after popular Prohibition-era cocktails or temperance drinks, temperance movement drinks. So the squirrel nut zipper is one of them. It's a lovely little chewy delight now made by the Necco Company. But at the time, it was made by the Squirrel Nut Company. So that's where the squirrel nut comes. As for the zipper, that was what they drank in the speakeasies. The zipper was popular, so they called it the squirrel nut zipper. Similarly, the nickel nip that we had talked about a minute ago, and that's a little wax bottle with, I'm not even sure what it is inside. It's a liquid and it's a very bold color. Those were likely named Nick because they cost a nickel, but Nip during temperance, they may look like a nip of whiskey.
What would you say is the strangest candy you've come across in the country?
The strangest candy? Gosh, there's so many strange ones. The new ones are so strange in the country. Nobody's ever asked me that. And I guess because so many are so strange, I've never really thought about it. I would say for me, the modern ones, I don't get it. Like the real pucker up ones that are so sour you can't breathe.
Yeah.
I would say those, I don't completely understand them. And the stories behind them are very short. Most of the stories of things, say, from the 50s and before have really long, fabulous histories. The really new ones, a lot of it's about marketing. I would say, in my eyes, something that doesn't exist in nature and has really no value to me. Those would be the stranger ones.
Well, the book is Sweet as Sin, the unwrapped story of how candy became America's favorite pleasure. Susan Benjamin, thank you so much for coming in.
Such a pleasure.
And that's it for this week's Cityscape. Never miss an episode of the show by subscribing to our podcast on iTunes. I'm George Boldarkey. Thanks so much for listening. See you.
It's WFUV and WFUV HD, New York. Listener-supported public media from Fordham, the Jesuit University of New York. Music discovery starts here.